The title of the forum, as mouth-filling, untangled, and graceless as you heard it at the meals, is generally accurate. What was announced was a session on, I think it was Your God is Alive and Well in American Popular Culture, Star Wars, and all that. And I give Larry Rasmussen great credit for having captured most of what I announced to him as a title for this presentation. Actually, the title of the session is Your God is Alive and Well and Appearing in Popular Culture. And I can only excuse that trivializing and cant topic by reporting that it's the title of a book which was published by a religious press a couple of years ago and which has partly inspired our concern here this evening. The origin of this session is a conversation which several of us, including Larry and Nyla Rasmussen, had last week about the displacement of Christian concerns and perhaps even the idea of God from the contemporary consciousness by so many of the images and legends and fantasies which come to us through the popular media, radio, television, film, print media, and so forth. And it also comes out of two experiences which I've had in the last couple of years. The first was reading at the insistence of one of my graduate students who was on his way to the Episcopal ministry, a book by John Nelson entitled Your God is Alive and Well in Appearing in Popular Culture, which was published by the Westminster Press in 1976. And a book with such a impossible title as that did not draw me immediately to it, but finally when I read the book at his continuing insistence, I was sufficiently upset about it to at least remember some of its contents. And the second background for this session, as far as I'm concerned, was seeing the movie The Empire Strikes Back about 4 weeks ago, which any reader of Time magazine would know by the cover essay of a month or 6 weeks ago, is the second saga in the Star Wars myth, which we're going to be treated to for a long time to come. Let me ask initially, how many of you have seen either Star Wars or both Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back? It's not mandatory, but enough so that we can pool some ideas. I want to make you a little worried about what you saw as we go along. I don't think it's insignificant for me to report the conditions under which I took our son and two of his playmates to see the film on a Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock as soon as they were out of school. The film opened at four theaters simultaneously in Los Angeles, which is almost unheard of. When a first-run film of major status opens, it's usually booked at only one theater in the Los Angeles area, and I assume the same is true for most other major cities, and it will run there for 2 or 3 months with an exclusive showing. The taste for The Empire Strikes Back, based on the phenomenal success of Star Wars, was expected to be so great that it was thought strangling to book it at only one theater, so it was booked at four theaters simultaneously. And the lines began queuing up outside the Hollywood Egyptian Theater 36 hours before the first showing. And the first woman in line had seen the predecessor, Star Wars, 176 times, and she wanted to be first in line. Even at $3.50 per showing, that's a hefty investment which she had made, not to mention the costume of Princess Leia and other things which she had tricked herself out in. At this particular theater, there was non-stop showing of the film for 144 hours, 6 days, after which the theater was closed on for 8 hours, time enough to shovel out the popcorn bags and sweep under the streets, and then it began to show again. It's something that is occupying a great deal of time and attention and money by a large number of Americans. Fortunately, I only had to wait for 2 hours and did manage to get tickets for the performance that I'd lined up for. I might mention just incidentally that after the film was over, I took my son and his friends across the street to his Svensson's ice cream parlor to relax, and in walked three of the major characters from Star Wars, Darth Vader, Princess Leia, and Luke Skywalker. Of course, these were groupies in very poor imitations of the garb and the physique of the movie itself. But this particular Svensson's was filled with transvestites and homosexuals and would-be Star Wars characters, like a scene out of Babylon. In any case, before going off in the direction of the Star Wars phenomenon. And as a forum, this should be primarily discussion. I do want to sketch in some of the context in which I think this phenomenon becomes spiritually and socially interesting to us. And the broadest area of concern that I have, and I think it's an area of concern that we're all feeling if we're not articulating it, is the relationship of mass culture and Christian faith. And I use the term culture here not in the broadest anthropological sense, where it can mean the entire lifeways of groups of people, but in a somewhat more restricted sense as the expressive acts of people. Those verbal arts, those visual arts, those rituals which we go through as a people, whether they be considered highbrow, middlebrow, or lowbrow, but ways in which we tell stories to one another and share ideas and establish common grounds of communication. There's already been some discussion touching on these areas in the week and a half that I've been here, the session on the electronic ministry or electronic religion, which I did not attend, I assume would have dealt with the qualitative change which simply media itself, mediated images, make upon the way people talk and think about God. And Mark Gibbs yesterday morning made a passing remark also about the influence of leisure time activities and the slow dripping of popular culture, television, etc., upon the bedrock of our minds and of our hearts, and raised a certain specter, I think, that in subtle and seemingly innocuous ways, our understandings and our convictions are being challenged almost each moment of the day. This concern about the connection between mass culture and Christian faith is not a new concern. Marshall McLuhan, in his book, Gutenberg Galaxy, carries it back in broader terms, at least to the 15th century, and to the invention of movable type, which made it possible for the first time to produce the Bible in quantity and in a language, through Luther's translation in the following century, which was democratically accessible to all people. If there had not been the invention of movable type, would the Protestant Reformation have occurred in the same way? Even if theologically it had been created, it would have been much more difficult to effect without this technological innovation. And certainly there were those within the Catholic Church who must have thought that the end of time had been reached when the Bible now could be published in relatively cheap editions and put into the hands of people themselves who were untrained to deal with the mysteries and with the interpretation of it. Likewise, in the 18th century, the appearance of the novel as a new literary genre also caused many graybeards to scratch their heads and wonder what had happened to classical learning and to classical taste, as now the large growing middle class, the bourgeois, had its own literary form to entertain, divert, and corrupt its mind. Up until the 18th century, the dominant literary forms were poetry and drama, and they were produced within coteries and presented, with some exception, of course, for relatively refined and select groups of people. But the novel was a popular form. It was a mass form, which would reach at least thousands of people simultaneously, and which would speak to the lowest common denominator of taste among them also. We descend to meet, at least in popular culture. The novel itself was regarded as a debauching of classical culture. Earlier in the 20th century, the alarms against the proliferation of popular cultural materials have been sounded by such figures as T.S. Eliot and Dwight MacDonald, who in the years immediately following the Second World War voiced their concern again about the corruption of the spirit and the mind and the taste of people by the proliferation of materials through comic books, through the expanding radio media, through the films, which had developed in sophistication and popularity during the 1930s. And of course, this has been further exaggerated by the introduction of television in the 1950s. We're plugging in, literally, to a long and growing history of concern about the challenge to orthodoxy and to theological concern by the images which fill our minds and which fill our airwaves. So the context in which we should have our discussion this evening, I think, is this broader context of mass culture and Christianity. It occurs to me that there are at least three ways of regarding these developments from a Christian standpoint, any or all of which we might discuss. The first grows out of Mark Gibbs' remark yesterday morning about what the laity does on Saturday or on most nights of the week in front of the boob tube or at the cinema or reading the comic section of your local newspaper. And I think it concerns the providential use of time, simply the amount of time which we and which our children and our friends give in a passive, receiving way to the images of the media should be of concern to us. If we have a stewardship of money, certainly we have a stewardship of time also. And the general substitution of the passive activity of watching television or going to the film for a more active engagement of life might be a matter of Christian concern. So this would be the first of three issues that I'd like to register in your minds. That is simply the use of time, which goes into popular culture. I feel like something of an outsider at this point. I haven't seen a television for 2 weeks. There aren't any here, right, at Holden. In fact, I sold our TV at a garage sale about a month and a half ago while my wife was out of town. Someone took her job. Although it had been sitting in the garage for a month or 6 weeks before then, it wasn't in very good working condition anyhow. So we're between televisions right now. We're being between marriages. A second issue or approach that I think we could take to this topic would concern Christian values and may address itself to the relentless assault on Christian values through the glamorization and romanticizing of what I think we could agree are non-Christian values through the media, such as the youth culture, the life of achievement and material success, of consumerism, the use of recreational drugs such as alcohol and marijuana and cocaine and so forth, which are dramatized on television, and what some of my students refer to also as recreational sex. I used to think of it as adultery or fornication, but my students call it leisure time sex or recreational sex. It calls up images of intramural sex teams sometimes. Recreational bowling, basketball, volleyball. And which is dramatized also on television. In some, a kind of demonic individualism in all ways, unlimited possibilities, not very often focused around the family or around the sense of community such as we've been concerned about it. It's often been said that no virgin was ever seduced by a novel. I have some doubts about that. But whatever the truth of it may be, there's a tremendous difference in verisimilitude and credibility between the essentially reflective and private act of reading literature and what we see visually depicted on the screen. It has power. The electronic media, film, and TV have achieved a sophistication and a qualitative impact that I think almost approaches the miraculous for us. And I've heard miracles of the Bible explained to children also by using metaphors or analogies from the popular media, analogies to Star Trek or Star Wars. The level of shock value and credibility, which previously I think has been reserved for religious mysteries, has begun to appear to us in this dramatic form on television. But the third concern is perhaps even more pressing to me and really was the inspiration for this session. If we might be concerned with the substitution of secular for Christian values through what is romanticized on television and film, I think we should also be concerned with the substitution of belief, of secular beliefs, of secular mythologies for the Christian mythology through the imaginative fictions which radiate from the TV and film. It may be possible to divide these categories up even finer than this, but I think it's one thing for us to talk about values and the impact which the media have on values, and a more fundamental concern to look for the displacement of actual belief, of the mythologies which we carry with us. And here, and I'm beginning to approach the end also of this too long introduction, I'd like to look at the word myth more explicitly. When most of us hear the word myth, I think we still take it to mean something that's unreal. Mythic, the adjectival form, often suggests this. If somebody gives us a fanciful notion we don't quite agree with, we'll probably reject it as a myth, as unreality. But literary critics, religionists, and anthropologists use the word myth in a different sense, not as distinguishing reality from unreality, but instead as defining a pattern of belief shared by a large number of people. A myth is a story. It's a narrative which defines the origins, defines and explains, legitimates the history, and also creates a future for a group of people who accept that central story. The American Dream, in one way or another, is a mythology for our country, which we'll be getting into more on Thursday night, also in the guise of civil religion. But myth is a story of supernatural origin, which explains the origins of life and traces the fate of a people through their history towards a final consummation of time. The cultural and spiritual function of myth is to bind a people together in shared belief and to give meaning and direction to their history. Christianity is a mythology in this sense. The Judeo-Christian mythology is what gives us our historical place and also our group identity. This mythology is not the exclusive mythology any longer. It probably never has been. But I think that the Judeo-Christian story, which we carry with us, the Old and New Testament stories and the commentaries thereupon, are coming under very fundamental challenge by alternative mythologies which are occupying perhaps the largest share of our minds and certainly the minds of our children. This came home to me in a very stunning way when I did see the second part of the Star Wars saga. I thought that the film, which came out 3 years ago, was a one-shot event, and we could enjoy it, and we could talk about it perhaps as somebody has as a Western space thriller, and forget about it after we had thrown out the last lightsabers that our children had bought. They'd lost their last little figures of Luke Skywalker and Han Solo and Darth Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi and so forth. It would wear out. Not true. Then in 1980 appears the second, not a sequel, but the second of what is going to be a 9-part series of movies. The brainchilds of George Lucas, who has the dubious distinction of being a cinema graduate from the university at which I teach, the University of Southern California. For those who may have missed the cover story in Time magazine, George Lucas, who is in his early 30s and is the son, I think, of a druggist in Fresno, California, has written a 9-part Star Wars saga. The movie Star Wars was the first part of the second of 3 trilogies. Now, if that makes sense, the 9 are divided up into 3 sections of 3. It sounds like incantations with holy numbers. And to present an opening gambit, he selected the first part of the second of the 3 parts for Star Wars, and The Empire Strikes Back is the second of these. And he has been very candid in acknowledging that each 2 or 3 years, for the next 15, 17, 18 years, we will be treated to yet another episode in the Star Wars history. Until an entire generation of 20 years to 25 years will have as its, he hopes, he expects, I think there's good reason to fear it, will have as its dominant popular experience the unraveling of the saga of Star Wars. For those who haven't cashed in or observed any part of this yet, I'm somewhat at a loss to explain what Star Wars is all about. Essentially, it's a very fanciful space drama involving two major forces. One is the force of Darth Vader, who is an arch-villain, 6 feet 7 inches tall or thereabouts, a half-bionic creature dressed in satanic black robes with a ferocious black helmet, And on the other, he's very well organized, and he leads the group of the Imperial Dynasty. And they search the far reaches of the galaxy trying to root out rebellion. And the rebellious forces are loosely organized, but their Prince Valiant is a man in white clothes named Luke Skywalker, who is very young. And he has a couple of shifty sidekicks. Two are mechanical. One is C-3PO, who is a little machine, and the other is R2-D2, who is another machine. Incidentally, these are the only two characters that exist throughout the entire 9 segments of the series. The human characters come and go, but the mechanical characters remain, because they can be rebuilt more easily than humans. And there's also a character named Han Solo, who is a sort of buccaneer of space, living on the border of the law, and continually debating in his mind whether it's in his best interest to help out the forces of lightness, Luke Skywalker, and so forth, or to live outside the law, which in this case, in a backwards way, means actually collaborating with the forces of the law, because the heroes are outlaws, and the villains are the forces of law, in this case. Behind the forces of good in the Star Wars experience, there is a very amorphous something called the Force. And the Force is a kind of deistic god, perhaps, faceless but all-powerful, and inspiring the people of the rebellion to eventually clean up the galaxy, such as it is. And there are a number of saints and apostles also who have served the Force in the past. You don't have to try to keep from smiling as I talk about this. It sounds so ludicrous to be serious about this sort of thing. And it's certainly not in my own sociology or family background to take popular culture too seriously. Except that I'm very upset, and I think we're going to have to eventually. Well, where was I now? Maybe I should mention just a couple of words about George Lucas's sources for developing this the new legend. He makes no secrets that he studied his Tolkien very well, and the Lord of the Rings lie behind what he is developing. He also makes no secret that he's been deeply influenced by Western formula fiction from the time of Tom Mix until Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, with a major emphasis on the Lone Ranger and Gunsmoke. This becomes particularly apparent in The Empire Strikes Back, incidentally, when some great horse-like battle stations of the Empire come stomping in across the frozen tundra to wipe out a rebel village, and the rebels fly little airplanes around horses and hobble them with unbreakable ropes, and mechanical battle stations collapse on the ground. And anybody who has digested as much TV or cinema Western lore as I have growing up in the 50s and 60s will recognize these immediately. They're so explicit and so outrageous that they're unmistakable and comic. He's also studied his Bible as another mythology that he can assume the mass of people out there in video land will be acquainted with, and which he can weave together in his saga. And there are no doubt other popular mythologies also which he is tapping and weaving together into this tapestry of the forces of light against the forces of darkness, represented by the guys in the white hats and the guys in the black hats. And it was possible, until The Empire Strikes Back, the second part of this too, to dismiss it all as so much fantasy. What shook me up, seeing the second of these, and I'm sorry if I take away some of the suspense for people who've seen the first but not seen the second yet, is that the satanic figure in the Star Wars story, Darth Vader, declares himself in the second episode to be the father, the biological father of Luke Skywalker, which leads to all sorts of psychological tensions within the young rebel. But the appeal is made to the young man in the most demonic of terms, as Darth Vader, who appears here as a fallen angel, as the archangel who was once first in the power and knowledge of the Force, in the forces of good, has rebelled against his maker, has declared his sovereignty, and now is seeking to win away from the Maker his other minions. And the temptation of Luke Skywalker is very much like the temptation of Christ also. And I'm worried Luke Skywalker may in subsequent issues die a redemptive sacrificial death, even in Birth of the Empire. I suspect that this happens. The books won't be published until the time the film come out. So even though they've been written, we won't know the story for another 15 or 20 years. Now what does all of this lead up to? First of all, the expenditure of money on this sort of thing. These films are grossing, and I think gross is a very good term to describe it. Hundreds of millions of dollars. There's no question that they will continue to be box office smashes. They're a major form of gift giving also. Children demand the artifacts from this experience, from this story, for birthday presents and special holidays and so forth. But I think more upsetting is the way in which it preempts or absorbs within it the Christian stories, both Old Testament and New Testament. We haven't gotten the Old Testament part of Star Wars yet. And at the very least muddies or confuses them in the minds of children and adults. Because of the immediacy, the impact, the visual spectacle of this, there's no way that they cannot be more vivid and more memorable for people who are seeing them than the narrated, less dramatic stories of the Testaments as they've come to us. At the very least, I think there will be a confusion and a watering down. There will be articles aplenty, I'm sure, in the coming years about the theology of George Lucas and the theology of Star Wars, which will attempt to define in which ways he's being heretical or not. I think at this point, the best generalization that could be made about the theology of Star Wars is that there's a kind of universalist Christian Science feeling to it, with more demonic power than Christian Science would ever admit to. But I can't articulate it any more clearly than that. And what I'm bringing here is a concern. I have no answers. There's no hidden agenda beyond this point. And if any of you share any of these concerns about the use or misuse of time by popular culture, about the effect which popular culture has on our value structures, or on the belief systems which we share, I think that could be the business for our forum. To close my part of this, I would mention again John Nelson's book, Your God is Alive and Well, Appearing in Popular Culture, in which he, written before Star Wars, comments on the replacement of the functions which religion has served culturally in prior times by the stories that are coming to us through popular culture. Making such declarations, for example, that the television occupies a space in the home which previously was served by the altar. It's a place where people meet. It's the media of communication. It's the object to which time is given, upon which money is lavished. It's the coin of the realm in conversation among people also. When you meet, you do not talk about Bible stories. You talk about the latest thing that you've seen on television. That's displacement. It's however theoretically and in the abstract one may declare their commitment still to a traditional Christian mythology, functionally, the mythology to which we are giving our obedience is that of the tube and the cinema screen. Well, enough of me. Let me hear from you. Yes?
I just was wondering if you, I was kind of confused by one of your last statements comparing Star Wars to Christian Science. Could you kind of elaborate on what parallels you see or exactly what you mean by that?
I'm confused in my own mind also, and actually ethical culture is a term that came to my mind before. But the struggle within Star Wars is between force of light and force of darkness. In Christian Science, evil would not be recognized as the reality that it is within Star Wars. There isn't that kind of dualism. I think, as I understand Christian Science, it regards sickness instead as a misconception of the mind and an incomplete understanding of God. But the dramatic conclusion of Star Wars, I think, may be something like the consummation of Christian Science belief, that the power, that one overcomes evil simply by believing so strongly in the good. And in The Empire Strikes Back, Luke Skywalker, the young soldier, goes to a distant planet and is instructed by a 3-foot-tall gremlin named Yoda, who is manufactured by Jim Henderson and his puppeteers, and is really a lovable little creature. But what he teaches his disciples is the power of belief, that if you believe you can do something, it is done. And he demonstrates this by squinting very hard and concentrating, at which a submerged starship rises out of the water again. Not action, not a code of behavior, but simply a power of belief, that one believes so strongly that evil vanishes in front of us, is wiped away, vaporized. It was in that sense that I was thinking of the Christian Science ethic. Call it now.
Is that the same thing that we grew up with Norman Vincent Peale, positive thinking? All you have to do is think it and you can do it.
You know, Lucy, though, if you had to design a mythology for 1980 in a computer, highly technological, hero-less world, how could you hit it better than George Lucas has? In a basically non-Christian country.
That's a question that I couldn't presume to answer, except that if it implies, if you were to design a mythology as best as you could, that the goal is acceptance, right, and success and celebrity and so forth, which it may all be for him. But to what end?
Every age has this mythology. We have, you know, the Hercules, the Thor, of the Greek mythology. And the last mythology that we've kind of gone through with the young people has been the Superman mythology, the Marvel heroes. Mm-hmm. And for any of you who have children who are in their 20s, that was kind of the last wave. And now the Star Wars is the current mythology, which really ties in with the world in which they live, which is very computer-oriented. Mm-hmm. There are some things about those movies which are very disturbing, but there also is just good and bad presented for the first time, I think, maybe in their lives. I don't know that that has been as clearly defined in our children's lives, and we have mostly teenagers, as that, you know, that's the first time that's really been brought out. There is that, and there is good. And I'm not sure that's ever been so dramatic.
Well, scholars of Superman, and there are people who call them such, connect the appearance of this particular figure in the 1930s with the general sense of powerlessness and decay which was felt in the culture.
There
was a projection then of a need to believe in a figure that had power over his own destiny and to identify with him vicariously. Ironically, Superman was invented by two Jewish fictionalists and traces its origins also to Nietzsche's Ebranch in a very direct way. But to what result, though, I think is a question that does it lead to engagement? Does it lead to ethical consideration? Or is it instead pure escapism? And there is a need, perhaps, for escapism within popular culture. But I think that we've come to a point, again, in the power and sophistication of the media, where it's not just escape, although people may assent that this is an entertainment, that it's unreality, that nobody would ever believe in that. But such large parts of life and belief are being displaced by this, that it becomes a matter of religious concern.
I get a little concerned when I have a 3-year-old who comes into my store and she had seen Star Wars 3 times and I hadn't seen it once. She could tell me all about it, and that was sort of startling to me. Mm-hmm. But the media, again, now the whole television thing, that really concerns me. Because I think that's a little different situation. I think you're talking about two things.
Would that be serials, television serials?
I would just say television, period. The amount of time that is spent and the amount of everything else that is displaced by television and the impact it has upon us, subliminal as well as actual.
Mm-hmm. We could follow that direction also. We needn't limit ourselves to Star Wars or to mythological alternatives.
Because I don't feel that I'm as upset with the presence of Star Wars or that children have something like that to have their fantasies or their make-believe time with, more than I am with the leniency which with there are television presentations. The shows that are preempted with the signals like, this is not recommended for children. Parents, use your discretion. The kids are right away going, oh, it's something we shouldn't see. Let's make sure we see it. And like I taught like fourth grade, and the undercurrency of sexual jokes and the idea that, like that movie channel that you can now buy, that if a parent doesn't supervise that, they get exposed to all the really nice movies. Or that the idea that parents were actually taking them to R-rated ones. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's just my mother's comment all the time, is they don't leave anything to your imagination anymore, you know, type of thing. And here, kids are always being exposed to it through television media and movies.
One of the problems also, probably, with this form of media is that there's no time for reflection. In reading, you can read at your own pace, and you can judge, and you can stop, and you can continually compare it to how you define yourself. That does not happen, either with television or with film, where the pace is dictated to you. And often leaves very little time for reflection in the act of viewing, although it may come later.
There's another hazard, a problem with particularly television. You know, right from the cartoons on Saturday morning to all those detective serials, westerns, and so on, and even including Star Wars, is that the hero always takes the reins of justice into his own hands and bypasses, you know, the legal machinery and due process, and that it is so pervasive that it's a wonder that you know, our kids grow up with anything but just a wink at the at the whole justice system. And it's very pervasive.
Those of you who have children of TV age, how do you monitor their television watching? Or maybe an earlier question, how much time do you think they actually spend watching TV?
You can set down guidelines, but the sticking to them is so difficult because the TV is there 24 hours a day, and it's almost impossible to hover to ensure that those guidelines are being followed. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that's the difficult. If it were going out to a movie, you know, you have a little bit more control over when they leave the house.
I'm always surprised when I hear statistics on TV viewing, because it's not true for our family or for most other people that we know. Our children have just not turned on to TV, except for Sesame Street in particular numbers. It hasn't been a lot of problems with us. I suspect that it's less of a problem within a group like this. Pardon?
If your TV's in the garage,
well, that was an isolated moment. We do have a small black and white in the house.
Well, how old are your children?
7 and 3.
The 7-year-old still wants to watch Sesame Street?
No, he watched it from about 2.5 until 5.5, for which we're very grateful.
Oh, yes.
And I think that our daughter would probably have been better prepared for preschool if she had watched Sesame Street also during that time. But aside from the Saturday morning cartoons, there just isn't time in the pattern of their lives really for watching TV. They watch very little. And I have the sense that perhaps people's children are watching less today than they actually were 5 or 10 years ago, which would be a helpful sign.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I have a 5 or 6-year-old, as far as, and, you know, you were asking people who have young children. You know, ours watch, it sounds like ours watch just about the same as what yours do, neighbor Sesame Street and Saturday. They've just recently started watching Saturday morning cartoons. So I think the thing comes when they start wandering to kids' homes and picking up TV shows there that they can monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think, you know, the key is constant monitoring. We just do that, and do a lot of talking about what they see and about what if we don't allow them to see things that you know, we don't want to turn on.
What sorts of things would you censor?
Well, for one thing, I think that cartoons, as violent as they are a lot less realistic and have a lot less impact than watching a photographed kind of like a police type drama. Anything that's filmed like that has a lot more impact than a cartoon kind of thing. And I just across the board monitor, I mean, they just don't watch things like that.
You know what I noticed though? We watch the news sometimes, and there's commercials on the news, or there's commercials on some programs which you don't think are really bad for children to watch. So here's my daughter standing at the mirror combing her hair all at one side and saying, "Look, Mom, I'm just like the beautiful lady on TV." Mm-hmm. Or you go to the Ice Capades with them, and there's two little girls, they're both four, and they're sitting there going, I'm that one, isn't she pretty? And that's from television. Beauty. You have to be pretty. You have to look at this one. And they're only four. And, you know, they don't watch, you know, Police Company or anything like that, but you get that from commercials.
But, you know, wait, I guess I sit and watch with them a lot. Even some programs I consider to be so boring, I just hardly stand to sit there. I mean, I sit and watch it with them so that I can talk to them about it. I think it's really
important. Oh, you can make fun of commercials?
Yes, I do that a lot. We talk a lot about why they're saying, you know, why they're saying what they are. You know, the kids will say to me, they just want my money.
Right.
you know, things
we
like
don't
that.
Have to buy that, Mommy, do we?
No.
Well, the dominant story, which I think characterized radio and television and film during the 50s and 60s, was the Western formula. And if you look at some of the charts of the most popularly viewed programs during the 60s, you find that 7 of the top 10 were Westerns. And there is a decline into the 1970s. The last of the real Westerns, I think, was McCloud, which some of you may observe, which had a Western character riding a horse oftentimes, but in New York City, and was really a satire of the Western itself, although the characters and the kind of individualistic daring do was still there. And there has been a good deal of thought on the connection between the entire idea of the American West from the middle part of the 19th century right into Vietnam. Thomas Hart Benton, who coined the phrase Manifest Destiny, for example, certainly was a figure who moved Congress and helped bring about the annexation of Mexico in the 1840s. If it hadn't been for Teddy Roosevelt's experiences in the West and the frontier, the entire course of the Spanish-American War would have been much different, and our conduct towards the good neighbor policy with Latin America would have been significantly different. I think that, while I know that much of Ronald Reagan's vocabulary still can be traced back to Death Valley days when he was the master of the mule team and the endless number of Westerns in which he was involved also. John Wayne's personal experiences are intimately related to some sections of the Republican Party in Southern California. And this is, it's a shared mythology of the country that we should have continuous open frontiers and that along the frontier line occurs a struggle between civilization and wilderness. And that there will be the upholders of law and there will be the evil criminals. William Hart's film Hell's Hinges in 1916 was the first to dramatize the guys in the white hats and the guys in the bad hats. Well, this, it's possible perhaps to say that I knew when I was a child, and others of us did when we watched Hopalong Cassidy and Roy Rogers and so forth, that it was just made up. But in some way it does affect our politics, and I suspect that it also affects our religion. And what we might be concerned about is the way in which values are creeping into our minds, into our belief systems, from what we're seeing today, and the impact that they have on us as Christians and as citizens. Excuse me.
Pretty much follows along those same lines. I think Star Wars is essentially an extension of the value constellation that you have in the Westerners. It's a morality play. It's good guys and bad guys. And as you mentioned, it's the good guys take the law into their own hands. I think that's just the 1970s or the 1980s. updating of a long-standing American complex. It may have wider impact because of the particular media, but essentially the story is the same one, seems to me. There aren't any limits. I mean, you transform everything according to human your own design.
One of the marks of the hero, though, the man in the white hat in the Western films, was that he was at least a passive, if not an active, Christian. Maybe the Quaker wife of Gary Cooper and High Noon that eventually redeems him. Or in the Ricochet comic strip, which I assume some of you get, even the bad guy, Hipshot Percussion, rides up in the hills and looks down at the church. And that church is the institution of morality and public value along the frontier. That is agreed on. It's static, and it's a Christian Trinitarian standard of society that is going to be fought for and won. And that has changed. We don't have any longer in Star Wars. It's a new religion for the new.
There's another set of images that come from TV of the clergy. They're either super cool personalities or else they are whimpering nothings. And over and over again I hear on TV, if somebody mentions something on talk shows about religion, the other person says, well, of course, you know, I'm an agnostic, you know. And usually this is a constant thing on TV anymore. Mm-hmm.
There's an embarrassment and an unsophistication, right, about having convictions or being orthodox. Orthodoxy itself is a dirty word. One does not want to be orthodox, but to be adaptive.
I'd like to go back to the Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back thing. It's so pervasive, you can't get away from it. Your kid goes down to the dime store and there's Empire Strikes Back trading cards. And when you're in the fourth grade, it's cool to have all 132 of them plus the 33 stickers so you can trade them with all your friends. At Christmas time, you get all the toys, or they want all the toys. And it's really, you know, it's easy to monitor TV watching. All you have to do is turn it on and turn it off. But the Star Wars thing is so, it's there wherever you go. And it's difficult to talk about that because it's so much a social thing among the peer group. Mm-hmm. It's a very frustrating thing to have to deal with.
Well, this has become a replacement for, like, what the Barbie and Ken dolls were. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry, because I remember that all it was when I was growing up was Barbie dolls and how much of a wardrobe you had. If you had a moving Barbie, if you had, you know,
go camping, you know,
if you had But isn't that true? How much emphasis is there on the Barbie now? Now it's moved on to Star Wars. And with the TV, if you turn it off and watch kids that have all the Star Wars characters and whatnots, because it's taking a lot more to motivate kids nowadays in the classroom, those who are teachers, motivation is just, you've got to be really creative. And in the same way with all the little toys from Star Wars.
You've got to be at least as good as when they turn on the tube.
Yeah. And better.
So all those years of watching Sesame Street, they just education needs to be so entertaining nowadays for them to stand on their head to teach in the classroom.
But that's what the toy industry and the movie industry is finding, like with Luke and Luke Skywalker. You know, that's got to be something that kids can really improve.
For any of you who have children, there is a very good book which I would certainly recommend to you. It's a paperback. It's called TV, the Plug-in Drug, or Plug-in Drug, the Effect of TV, and it's very frightening. And it really talks about what is, especially for teachers.
I think there is a connection between the kind of medium that you're talking about and the kind of behavior that you get. And at that point, it is less a question of monitoring the programs than it is whether that should be viewed at all because of the impact of the medium. I'm not as enthused about Sesame Street as I was when I used to watch it all the time. But you have to throw that thing. I mean, the kids, you know, poking you or something, shut up. Let me watch the rest of this program. But the episodes are presented with such rapidity. It's you just move from snapshot to snapshot. Mm-hmm. It's experiencing this and then experiencing that. There's no savoring of anything. There's no sense of something persisting over time that requires caring for. It is, in Daniel Bell's phrase, an engorging of every experience and every style that comes along. And I think that sort of immersion into episodic experiences that have no ongoing texture over a long period of time results in people who then take on that characteristic of sort of engorging any and every experience and style that comes along and see the world that way. No sense of history and no sense of extended care. Mm-hmm. No sense of time except this episodic sense of time. Things happen, they pass on. So that the fads, the Barbie doll and whatever, I mean, it's, and I think Sesame Street, I think Sesame Street reinforces that. That's one kind of thing in which I think values are shaped, but not because of the presentation of good and evil, but of a presentation of a style of living, a way of looking at the world.
Sesame Street has been criticized by some also for the way in which it immediately resolves trivial conflicts, that there is no deep and enduring problem ever to be solved.
There's no deep and enduring anything mm-hmm. on the television.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the soaps.
Well, that's right.
Barbie dolls sound fairly innocuous on surface, but what is your experience with the Barbie doll? Not personally, but your judgment. Do you see them as a trivial diversion that was nice to have?
Extreme jealousy.
That's precisely the point that Betty Friedan made also in The Phantom of the Mystique, that the Barbie doll is a symbol for American womanhood, which was produced in...
That one, along with like Gidget and the beach...
Like Bingo.
Mm-hmm. No, girl meets guy... Guy next door with the white teeth and
she was a symbol, a model for womanhood and kind of
can you change the theme just slightly? I haven't seen Star Wars, but the reaction I got from my students and even some younger kids was Darth Vader was the hero. That's who everybody wanted their Halloween costume to be. That's who the kids talked about in high school, was that evil was the greatest thing. And my kids love all the mafia characters. They identify, even though they're black, they identify with Al Capone. It's evil that is so great. Now, maybe that's big city. You know, and pimps have the money and have the fancy cars and the clothes. I don't know, but you know, even little kids, Darth Vader was it. Mm. Luke Skywalker was wishy-washy. Nobody wanted this.
Seems to me this whole discussion, the entire discussion, reverts to a very simple theme, namely the mentality of children. Whether physical children or adult children. all the concerns I've heard voiced are by worried adults who are concerned about bringing those children into the world of adults by actions that they take, at first they. It really doesn't matter whether the kid's poor and his choice is TV as a babysitter or the corner, the street corner, or he's given a book, you know, by the parent to read. It's not going to happen on the part of the kid once he's directed something of a higher order than TV. And our whole theme seems to be the babysitting component of TV and the movies here. Let's give him something else to do, pure and simple, whatever we can afford, whatever we know, things we learn instead of TV and before TV. It's no great mystery.
Well, for some people, that's Monday Night Football.
Well, that goes back to family unity, I think. Because like you said, TV became the babysitter. And so it was easy to say, go watch the TV instead of taking an interest in your children.
But I think even in the days when there was family unity, kids still had heroes. Mm-hmm. There just wasn't so much paraphernalia. You know, if you were a fan of Mickey Mantle, then you had all the Mickey Mantle baseball cards, right? You watched all the games. You didn't spend a lot of time and energy thinking about Mickey Mantle. My kids do today.
Could we ask a fellow with the sandy hair and the glasses to appear as an expert witness? Have you seen Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back?
I have seen Star Wars, but not The Empire Strikes Back, but I do know a lot about The Empire Strikes Back.
How did you find out about it?
I read the book 2 times. And I have almost every single card in the series.
Okay, now the book The Empire Strikes Back by English teachers has been very highly regarded.
Has been what?
Highly regarded.
It's a good story.
It's a well-written book.
It reads well. Let me follow this up just a moment and ask which you talk about more often and feel more acquainted with, the New Testament stories, the Old Testament stories, or Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back. That's a loaded question.
I'm not even sure I understand half of it. I understand half
of it.
Feel more comfortable in school about talking about Star Wars and that kind of thing.
Do you think any of your friends really believe that it's happening?
Well, there might be some and there might not. I'm not quite sure.
Thank you.
Luther?
Mm-hmm.
Could throw one in on that. In our community, they have a community Halloween party. And then a year ago, last Halloween, they found a kid who put together a radio-operated R2-D2. And in the middle of the party, they had this R2-D2 running around. And my daughter commented afterwards, she said, I always thought it was just a story. Now I think he's real.
That's a good sign, and she always thought it was a story.
Yeah, I didn't know whether it was such a good idea for a three-man robot.
There hasn't been, as far as I know, the emergence of such cults around Star Wars as there was around Star Trek, which I don't understand at the moment. But their conventions are really something to behold.
Yeah.
Lost, drifting people, often physically unattractive, if not just emotionally deformed, who flock to it, and in whose lives it does serve a religious function.
Because just like a year ago in L.A., they had their convention where everybody dressed up as Star Wars characters. They couldn't get in unless they were dressed up as a Star Wars character.
Star Wars?
Yeah. It was a Star
Wars. I was impressed with a statistic that I heard on just a television watching, and I don't have the details, but I can tell you the summary, and that is that kids who watch a lot of television are statistically incredibly more influenced by their peers than they are by their parents, and much more so than those non-television or minimal television watching teenagers. That
Yes, Mary?
At this point, then, those who don't watch television are active in other things. They don't need television. Now, it might not necessarily be the family, but they're into other activities, swim clubs or play, kids who play sports do not have time. Spend much time in TV.
We've approached the end of our time, and I would make just one effort to bring to a conclusion a very open-ended discussion, and that's to state the obvious, that it behooves us all to be concerned about not only the amount of time that our children are spending and that we are spending. I think this has probably been too limited to children, and unfairly so, that we are spending in passive diversions, passive entertainments. To be concerned not only about the quantity, but also about the storylines and the content. Not to turn the television off, perhaps, or sell it at a neighborhood garage sale, but to be aware ourselves of the stories, of the values, and of the modeling which is occurring in what is observed, and perhaps to talk about it, at the very least. To know it, to understand with it explicitly, and to clarify for ourselves and for our children the extent to which it is escape, entertainment, diversion, and those places also in which it becomes a challenge and becomes a corrosive force, I think, on the values that we try to carry through our lives and to pass on to next generation.